This podcast is brought to you by ClearBridge Investments. Meet an evolving economy confidently with ClearBridge Active Equities, the foundation of a resilient portfolio. ClearBridge, a Franklin Templeton company. Go to clearbridge.com to learn more.
Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode. Welcome to the Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. In this week's special episode, David Harrell from Morningstar Investment Management and Kevin Brown from Morningstar Research Services do a deep dive into the top three companies on Morningstar's REIT coverage list.
I'm David Harrell, editor of Morningstar Dividend Investor Newsletter, and I'm here today with Kevin Brown, who is a Morningstar analyst who specializes in the coverage of REITs or real estate investment trusts. Kevin, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Could you start out by just talking a little bit about your role and Morningstar's coverage of the REIT industry?
Sure. So I've been covering REITs for my entire professional career for the past 18 years. And so right now at Morningstar, I cover all the core real estate sectors, all the REITs in them. So that includes office, retail, which includes malls, shopping centers, and the triple net REITs, the residential REITs, which includes both apartments and single family rental homes, the hotel REITs, healthcare REITs, industrial REITs, and self-storage REITs. In total, that is 27 total companies at the moment. And we do cover a handful of other REITs throughout Morningstar, but those are handled by some other analysts. That includes the cell phone towers, data storage REITs, and the timber REITs. So my analysis today is going to be primarily focused on the core sectors that I cover.
Okay. And those are all U.S.-based REITs, correct?
Correct. Yes. Those are all U.S. REITs, and their portfolios are almost entirely concentrated in the U.S.
Okay. Great. Now, you recently released a great research report on REITs and dividends. So there's lots there of interest for income-focused investors. But I wanted to start out with something else, and that's economic moats. And as you know, the Morningstar approach to equity analysis is sort of built around this concept of economic moats or firms' ability to defend themselves against from their competitors. And the idea being if you're earning excess returns on capital and you can sustain your competitive advantages for at least 10 years, Morningstar analysts will award a firm a narrow economic moat. If they can sustain those advantages for 20 years or more, it'll receive a wide moat rating. Now, in your report, you're highlighting those 27 REITs under coverage, but none of them currently earn a narrow or wide economic moat rating. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Why do none of the REITs have these sort of sustainable competitive advantages right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's because at Morningstar, we have a very strict definition for what constitutes an economic moat. And as we go, we do a very rigorous analysis each and every company that we cover. And just unfortunately, none of the REITs, their portfolios meet that strict definition. And you can give, different reasons for different sectors, for say hotels or for office companies, they only own a very small percentage of the buildings, in their sectors, in the markets that they're concentrated in. Some of the most concentrated hotel REITs, only own maybe 10% of the hotel rooms in the markets that they're most concentrated in. So not enough for them to actually generate pricing power. And that doesn't even include, say, the Airbnb type of shadow supply in those markets. Very small percentage of actual assets owned, the very large, U.S. real estate market. Another issue that many run into is that there's, almost no barriers to entry for many of these sectors. For example, apartments in suburban settings, very easy to build new apartment buildings, just down the street that will be very similar to what the REITs currently own. Same thing with, say, self-storage facilities. You can go down the road and build, in just any plot of land, a self-storage facility, pretty much wherever you want. Another major issue is that, they're limited by their ability to push rents on their tenants without having their tenants say, we could just do this ourselves. I'll give the example of the industrial REITs. They have some very large tenants that can afford significant rent increases each and every year, say Amazon, FedEx, you know, they can afford that to a certain extent, but they can't extract extravagant, you know, profits from them without having Amazon or FedEx just say, we're better off, you know, with our own facilities. You know, the REITs provide flexibility and can expand and allows, you know, their tenants to focus on other things other than owning real estate assets, which is why it's a great marriage, but you don't want to upset your partner. So you can't push too hard. There's a limit. And the final thing is many operators or tenants, you know, run very thin margins. So you're limited to how much you can push rents, even if, you know, you are the stronger one in the, you know, the leverage dynamic. You know, for example, you know, retail REITs, you know, if you are, you're only able to push rent to match what revenue growth is for your retail tenants. And the retail tenants are only seeing limited, you know, sales growth at brick and mortar locations. Same thing with, say, the senior housing REITs. You're only able to push it as much as the operator who you hire to run the property is able to withstand without sending your operator into bankruptcy, because they're the ones who are running the facility. So that's a big concern there. However, we do think that they can make economic profits, and they are, you know, strong companies. We just tend to define that as, you know, the source of that is more from management teams, strong management teams, rather than economic moats. And so management teams, you know, can turn over fairly quickly. And so it doesn't meet the definition of, you know, needing 10 to 20 years. But, you know, they can do things like many operate at margins well above the rest of their peers. I'll give the example in hotels of Pebblebrook Hotel Trust. You know, their whole story is that they would buy hotels that were poorly run by other operators and, you know, come in and implement cost efficiencies and turn around the operating margin from, say, the teens into the 30s. Same thing with, say, Welltower, a senior housing healthcare REIT. They operate with so many different senior housing operators that they've learned best practices and know what works best in each and every market and region. And so they're able to tell, you know, their operators, we think you could improve margins by doing X, Y, or Z that somebody else is doing. And because they have so many different relationships and operations going on at once, they can see what works best for everybody and push those efficiencies across their whole portfolio. And but that's really expertise of management that's not necessarily institutional to the real estate itself. So other things that the REITs can do is they have, you know, significant ability to develop new properties at high development yields. You have the industrial REITs that are very good at this. The apartment REITs for the past decade have been very strong at doing this. And so a lot of what they're able to do is build at a development yield higher than, you know, the market average and creating cash flow, you know, higher than the debt that they're funding it with. And finally, many are able to secure relationships with outside developers and acquire off-market deals. For example, Invitation Homes, a single family rental REIT, is able to work with home builders and buy entire communities, you know, but from those home builders before they even hit the market. And they're able to, because they can pay for the entire community up front, you know, they're willing to cut Invitation Homes a deal. And so are able to get at better than market deals. And so that's how they're able to generate cash flow. But again, that's a relationship that's not necessarily, it won't be necessarily transferred if the management team turns over. So that's not really a moat, but it is a where we think of exemplary stewardship, you know, sort of generates, you know, excess cash flows for many of these companies.
Got it. So you might look for something like the allocation rating or something else, as opposed to looking for a moat, simply because there's not going to be a moat rating for any of these firms.
Correct.
Okay. Now, in your report, obviously, you know, by definition, REITs must distribute 90% of their net income as dividends each year in order to maintain their tax-free status. But you note that there's actually a fair amount of flexibility because cash flow can be quite a bit higher than net income. So the sort of the 90% is a sort of a floor is for in terms of distribution, and that could rise all the way to 100% of the REIT's cash flow. What do you like to look for in terms of the balance there, in terms of how much a REIT is distributing?
Yeah, so you know, net income is a floor, but it's not really a floor that is frequently too big of a concern for most of these REITs because they do incur such large non-cash charges. The largest generally being depreciation and amortization, and so that often, while they're generating positive cash flow, many times they will see net income be near or close to zero. And it's, you know, 90% of something that's close to zero is basically not a requirement for many of these guys. And in times where good, they still are paying out well above net income. So the REITs all produce a metric, an industry standard metric called funds from operation. And that's the REIT standard cash flow metric that everybody uses and adheres to a strict definition of how they calculate funds from operation, or FFO. However, one of the big non-cash charges is depreciation, which the cash charge is capital maintenance expenditures. So we like to take the FFO that the companies report and then add to it what we assume is the appropriate level of capital maintenance expenditures necessary to maintain the overall quality of the portfolio and to create something called AFO. And so when we look at AFO, we like to see companies typically pay out about 85% of AFO over the long term in terms of dividends. If you get to 100%, you can go over 100% for a few quarters by, taking out a little bit of extra debt or paying, down, using up cash on your balance sheet. But you can't sustain levels above 100% for a long time. But if you're well below that level, you're not really paying out to your shareholders. We often find that there's not that many excess uses of cash that are really going to generate value for shareholders. So you might as well give shareholders that dividend that they are expecting. So really, I think 85% is an appropriate level for them to be at. And in our analysis, this actually tends to be over the long term where most companies cluster. And the companies that, fall outside of a range of, say, plus or minus 5 or 10% from, say, the 85% target range, generally there's something going on with that company that can explain it. Like a lot of variability, say, in the hotel industry, where there's big spikes or falls, that causes them to, fall outside of it for an extended period of time.
Okay. And that's 85% of AFO, or adjusted funds from operations.
Correct.
Okay. Now, the other thing that you caution against in your report is simply buying REITs based on yield numbers alone. And I believe looking back to the year 2000, of the 27 REITs under coverage, I believe 20 of them have had at least one dividend cut during that time period?
Correct. REITs, they generally try to not cut their dividend. And the big reason is that it just sends a terrible message to investors that, the cash flows to the firm are significantly lower than their prior expectations and that the current dividend is unsustainable. The dividends for almost all REITs is very, very sticky. And you build it up slowly over time at a sustainable pace. But if you have to cut, that's saying that cash flows are impaired. And so part of the issue is that it causes, many income-oriented investors that depend on the dividend to lose trust in the company. And it's really hard to reestablish that trust. It could take a decade to convince investors that, we're not going to cut again as soon as our cash flows start to waver a bit. There's only two major types of events that we've seen REITs over the past 20 years, cut. One is, if there's major company reorganizations, these are fairly rare, major divestitures, or, you're spinning off various parts of your business, or just there's some major isolated events that are, specific to you, but these are very, very rare events, you know, only happening a handful of times across all of our coverage list over the past 20 years. So really the major driver of dividend cuts is recessions, economic recessions that have happened over the past 20 plus years. So the main ones, of course, are, you know, the 08-09 financial recession and the most recent pandemic. We saw, you know, more than half of the REITs we cover cut their dividend in each of these recessions. Now, generally, you know, I think the market recognizes in a recession that, you know, your cash flow is going to be significantly lower than your prior expectations. And so the penalty for cutting your dividend during a recession is far smaller. And you might as well lump in, you know, bad news altogether and just get it out of the way and say our cash flow is going to be lower because of the recession. And as a result, we are cutting our dividend. And that's what many of the REITs have done over the past 20 years. Now, in the 08-09 recession, the dividend cuts generally were caused more by frozen debt markets than necessarily the wavering cash flows. The issue was just that REITs were just not able to issue new debt to pay off existing debt. And so, you know, they had to use cash on hand to pay off debt as it came due. You know, many just delayed their cuts, you know, even though the recession started in 08, most of the cuts, dividend cuts didn't happen until 2009 because they just waited as long as possible to see if there was any other alternatives. But for many of these REITs, they were operating very high leverage levels in 07 and into 08. And so just they had significant amount of debt coming due in 2009. And so they were forced to, you know, do a combination of things. One was make major cuts to their dividend. And another thing was many of the REITs had to sell off assets as their debt came due because they just weren't able to tap into the debt markets. Now, more recently than during the pandemic, we saw a recession where, you know, many thought that cash flows for these companies were going to be significantly impacted. And for a handful of them, say the hotel companies in particular, they really were significantly impacted. But for a lot of the other ones, I think there was a much more fear and uncertainty and just they wanted to get ahead of things and not wait till the last possible minute to cut. And so almost all the REITs who did cut, so about half of the REITs under our coverage, did so within the first 3 months of the pandemic. Now, some of this was done opportunistically, remembering the prior recession where I said, you know, that many companies were forced to sell assets. Well, they thought, well, this pandemic is going to cause many of our competitors to have to sell a significant number of assets. And if we have cash on hand built up, you know, we're going to be able to pounce and get some great deals and acquire at some great cap rates. Now, that never really came to be. I think the impact to the cash flows were not nearly as great. And so there weren't the fire sales going on. And so many of the companies have since reinstated their dividends, or at least, you know, made it a little bit better than the initial cuts that they had. They've raised it back up, maybe not fully, but, you know, they've reinstated similar dividend yields to what they previously were at.
Okay. So you've seen some recovery in, if not the rates themselves, at least the yields that they're producing at this point.
Correct. I mean, the spread between, say, the average dividend yield for the average REIT in 2019 over the 10-year U.S. Treasury was about 75 basis points. And that spread today between the average dividend yield over the 10-year U.S. Treasury is about 75 basis points. So it's about the same spread over your, you know, U.S. Treasury option today.
Got it. And in your report, you also gave the example of how one specific example of how a very large and quickly growing yield might point to a looming dividend cut. Can you share that example?
Yeah, and the reason I bring this up is, you know, I want to warn investors against just looking for the highest dividend yield as being the best possible investment. Right. I mean, today, the best ones out there, the highest yields we're seeing are in the office REITs. And I caution that, like, you know, just a couple of years ago, we were looking at, you know, say Macerich had the highest dividend yield under our coverage. Historically, Macerich has always paid a high dividend yield. Over the past 10 plus years, they've averaged around a 4.7% dividend yield. So, very healthy dividend yield over the long period of time. And you're going into 2018, they were slightly above that, but not too concerning at 5%. However, the dividend yield is a combination of both, the dividend payout per share, but also the company's price per share. And so since the dividend per share is very sticky, but the price changes very quickly, you can see a rapidly moving a price that drives, a high dividend yield. And that's what's going on with Macerich. The price in 2018 was slowly falling due to increased e-commerce pressures, thinking that, brick and mortar retail was going to continue to lose sales to online sales. But really the big driver of the company's decline at the end of 2018 was the announcement of Sears total bankruptcy. We had some long-term positive views on the Sears bankruptcy. Sears had never paid a high rent to Macerich, and they weren't driving significant traffic to those malls. However, it's going to take a long time for Macerich to redevelop the assets and to reestablish the lost cash flow that Sears was paying, to bring in the newer, healthier tenants who are going to pay more rent. And that redevelopment projects that they're going to have to do across their portfolio, we're going to total in the hundreds of millions of dollars in cash. And that cash, is going to compete with other priorities for the company, which include continuing to make dividend payments. And so while they have to pay out to, redevelop these properties and they had less cash flow, it made it more likely that the company was going to have to cut the dividend. This was made even worse in 2019 when we saw a record number of stores closing in 2019. We had over 10,000 total retail stores close across the U.S. And so Macerich continued to see its price fall, which led to the dividend yield continuing to go up.
So investors were probably attracted to this, right? As this yield is shooting up, you have some investors who are buying in based on that number alone.
Correct. Yeah. So you had the price go from the low 50s in 2018 to the low 20s at, 2019. It seems like a great deal. It's too attractive to be true. I mean, the dividend yield in, when it was down to the low 20s, was now in the double digit range. It was like 12, 13%, 14%. And this was pre-pandemic. And so when the pandemic came along, that shot the dividend yield up to 30, 40, 50, 60% as the price fell down to the single digit range. And eventually management had the excuse it needed to make a dividend cut. Now, if the pandemic hadn't happened, a dividend cut was still probably likely. It was getting away from itself. It needed to correct its course and needed to free up the cash to make the development of the Sears assets. So it was probably likely, but the pandemic sort of accelerated that and allowed it to course correct. And so now the yield has been stabilized to a much more appropriate range that today is in the low 4%. And that's, closer to the company's historic average.
Got it. So in your report, you did some great stuff. And one is you basically ranked all of the REITs under coverage by their historical dividends. You created a 1-5 rating based on multiple factors, mm-hmm. and rated all the REITs, rated the REITs and ranked them. And then you did the same sort of looking forward in terms of sustaining and growing their dividends. So then you have this ranking based on future dividends. You took the two of those rankings, added in the Morningstar star rating, I believe, and current yield to create sort of an overall ranking of your REIT universe. And you came up with your three top picks, I believe, currently. And I was wondering if you could share those with us.
Sure. So the first company want to recommend is Federal Realty Trust. It's a shopping center REIT. So It is one of the three members of our coverage list that is in the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats Index. And it's a very strict standard to adhere to. You have to not only, not have any dividend cuts, you have to raise your dividend each and every year for 25 straight years. It's very difficult for many companies to adhere to that strict list. Again, only three of the 27 companies we cover actually manage that standard. And Federal Realty, stands out as being, it's a retail REIT, and many other retail REITs have had dividend cuts because of the pressures that they have faced from, declining brick and mortar sales. However, Federal Realty has found a way to continue to raise it, and it's their top priority. They want to make sure that they are able to continue to pay a strong, consistent dividend. And even during the pandemic, when you had the payout ratio go above 100% for a couple of quarters, they stuck through it and have emerged out the other side back to their historic, level of around 85% of AFFO is where they pay out their dividend, and they raise it each and every single year. And so they've had a great track record. And going forward, we think that they should be one of the top retail REITs in terms of overall growth because they are focusing on some major development projects of mixed use retail. So you not only have ground level of retail shops and big boxes, but on top of that, you're building office buildings, apartments, and hotels, which should give those retail shops a captured audience of, somebody who always going to be there shopping at your stores, because frankly, that's one way that it's easier than online shopping to go shopping in person, is if you're just have to go down to the ground floor to go to the store. They've got some very large projects. They've completed some that have been, really well reviewed. And we think that Federal Realty is just a great opportunity for not only for income-oriented investors, but anybody looking for a REIT investment. The next company is Realty Income. This is a triple net lease REIT, which means that, they basically are not responsible for the vast majority of expenses towards maintaining their properties. They have retail tenants who are lease their portfolio of assets that are all sort of the corner store. Say, imagine, Walgreens and CVS on the corner of major busy intersections. And they own those buildings, but the tenant is responsible for all the operating expenses and also responsible for all the maintenance of the property itself. They have to pay for the maintenance. And so Realty Income just sits back and collects a simple rent payment from them without having any major expenses. It makes it a very safe, stable business, and are able to, even in recessions, their cash flows are not changed very much because they have such a wide cushion between what the operator, the tenant's cash flows are versus the rent payments, that their rent payments are never at risk of being potentially cut. And so because they have stable revenue growth, they're able to promote a stable income of dividend to shareholders. And this is another member of the S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats Index. And they dubbed themselves the monthly dividend company because, again, their top priority is paying out a dividend to shareholders. Stable...
And they do that on a monthly basis, as they say.
Monthly dividend, yes.
Is that common within the industry, or is that fairly rare?
No, that is fairly rare. They're the only ones in our coverage who pay out a monthly dividend. All the rest pay out a quarterly dividend.
Okay.
So, but they dub themselves, they give themselves their own name of the monthly dividend company. I mean, they say dividend company because, paying a dividend is, again, one of the top priorities for this company. That's why they also are at the top of our overall rankings.
And Kevin, your third pick was a firm that's its cash flow was definitely impacted during the pandemic, correct?
That's correct. So our third recommendation is Ventas, which is a healthcare REIT. So they focus on three separate healthcare sectors. Senior housing, which saw a very big impact from the pandemic, but also they own medical office and life science. And one of the things that we like about them is that they do have their life science and their medical office portfolios, which were not impacted by the pandemic and generally should be relatively defensive during most recessions. Medical office is a portfolio that, you know, just should continue to grow at 2-3% every year and is insulated from most economic impacts. Life science is a sector that should have a significant growth ahead of it as, you know, many pharmaceuticals continue to invest in their overall research capabilities and many universities are expanding their research campuses. And so Ventas is the partner that can provide the clusters of life science buildings necessary to continue to fuel that growth. And they're seeing significant growth in the 4-6% overall growth every single year from that segment. So those two segments were not impacted by the pandemic. However, their largest, which is, represents about 40% of the overall company's cash flows, senior housing was impacted by the pandemic. But we think this provides a significant opportunity for growth going forward. Now, senior housing was one of the biggest things impacted by the pandemic because you know, seniors were very sensitive to the virus. It wasn't that there was any major outbreaks at the facilities of Ventas. It was more so that there were issues with the facilities being quarantined if there was any contact tracing that led to the facility. So if a visitor had contact, you know, that if a visitor had the virus, or if somebody who worked there may have had the virus, they would have to shut down the entire facility for an extended period of time. And that meant that you were not bringing in new residents. And so doing that several times throughout the pandemic led to occupancies falling from the mid 80% range to the mid 70% range in about a year's time. Now, since the vaccine has been developed and started rolling out among the senior population, we've seen a significant recovery in occupancy, with occupancy growing month over month, every single month over the past year, since about March of 2021. And it's even continued to see positive growth through the Delta and the Omicron variants. Now, it's not back up to its prior levels, but it's encouraging to see occupancy start to get back up close to where it previously was. However, we think that occupancies are going to continue to, you know, reach that level and then push through as we see the overall 80 plus population continue to grow. The baby boomers are just starting to age into the target age for these facilities. And so while the past decade, we saw the 80 plus population grow at an average rate of about 1.5%, we're at about 3% right now. And that rate of growth is only going to continue to accelerate up to around 7% by 2027. So that's a huge amount of demand growth. Meanwhile, supply growth, which had been above historical average prior to the pandemic, construction starts went to about zero during the height of the pandemic, and even today is still well below historical average. And since these facilities take anywhere from 2 to 3 years to build, you know, we see out you know, several years that we're going to have very low supply growth. So with rapidly expanding demand growth and low supply growth, we think that occupancy is going to continue to push northwards into around the 90% range, which is where we were at back in 2010, 2011 timeframe. And back then we saw rent growth of 4-7% on an annual basis. And I think with that, you're going to see some very strong growth from senior housing, and that should therefore, you know, fuel strong cash flow growth, which should also fuel strong dividend growth. And okay, so we think that this is going to be a you know, company that's going to see lots of growth going forward, and, you know, should be a good investment for all investors, you know, for both those looking for strong growing dividends, but also for investors looking for a company that's just growing its cash flows.
Great, great. So it's one of the firms that did have a dividend cut during the pandemic, but your outlook is very positive for the firm right now.
Correct. And historically, I mean, over the past, 20 plus years, that pandemic cut, just because of the uncertainty of senior housing cash flows, that's the only time that they have cut their dividend. They made it through the 08-09 timeframe without cutting their dividend, even though the majority of companies we cover did cut their dividend during that time period. Ventas did not. So this is one exception to Ventas's history.
That's great insight, Kevin. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
That does it for this week's Investing Insights podcast from Morningstar. We hope you have enjoyed our program and we welcome your feedback. Please send your comments and questions to podcast@morningstar.com. From everyone here at Morningstar, thanks for listening. This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. The podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered tax advice. Please consult a tax and/or financial professional for advice specific to your individual circumstances. Morningstar Research Services, LLC is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analysis, or opinions or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.